Hello, I'm Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and I'm inviting you to join me on season 3 of my podcast, Duchess. In the show, we explore the most historic homes of the UK and Ireland and meet the inspiring women who lead them. This is Duchess. In the southwest county of Dorset, where fossils of an ancient world line the sand-spotted shores of the Jurassic coast, there is a historic home that can transport you back to a time gone by, Ford Abbey. Like the name suggests, Ford was a Cistercian monastery in the Middle Ages. Emboldened stone arches, towered facades, high ceilings, and clerestory windows, Ford Abbey is a beautifully preserved treasure. For hundreds of years, this was the centre of Christian learning, faith, and piety. But within its 1,600-acre estate, there is more to this ancient abbey than just veneration. Ford Abbey is also well known for its bewitching gardens and beautiful tapestries. The current custodian is Alice Kennard, who lives at Ford Abbey with her husband Mark. For over 100 years, Alice's family, the Ropers, have been dutiful and devoted custodians, preserving and building up the estate to the present day. Coming up in the episode, Alice describes the fascinating monastic history of Ford Abbey and why it was one of the most important in its time. Alice describes the beauty of her award-winning garden, and I learn about the highly coveted Raphael tapestry that hangs on an abbey wall.
Today, listeners, I am absolutely delighted to be joined by Alice at Ford Abbey. And where exactly, Alice, is Ford Abbey for our listeners' sake?
Ford Abbey is in the southwest of England. We sit on the border between Dorset and Somerset and about 3 miles from Devon. So we're almost no man's land for everybody, but about 10 miles from the coast.
10 miles from the coast on the borders of Dorset and Somerset. What a beautiful countryside. Looking out at rolling fields, I guess.
We are, yes.
So this estate remained an abbey for hundreds of years. When did it actually become a private home?
Ford was founded as a Cistercian monastery in 1146. And the land, interestingly, was bequeathed by a female called Adelicia de Brionis, who lived in Thorncombe, which is our local village. And the Cistercians settled here and spent really 200-300 years building the monastery. And it became one of the probably top 3 or 4 Cistercian monasteries in the country and became very powerful. At its height, it was controlling about 30,000 acres. Really, Thomas Chard was the last of 32 abbots, and he was really key because he was very energetic and he really remodeled the monastery. He refaced the cloisters, he built what is now the Great Hall, and he made the kind of abbot's quarters, which is now our private area where we live. When Henry VIII came along and dissolved the monasteries, for Ford's luck really, it was in very, very good condition because he'd had a real building phase for nearly 20 years. So although he did give it up to the Crown and went to become Vicar of Thorncombe, he left a building that was, you know, it wasn't falling down, it was in tip-top condition. And so when it was left empty for 100 years, it actually coped and it didn't decay and it didn't fall into disrepair. I mean, obviously bits of it must have done. We've always said there must have been somebody here to snow off the roofs and things, but otherwise there's kind of 100 years that's a bit empty in its history until Edmund Prideaux came along and converted it into a house. He was Oliver Cromwell's Attorney General and he was also MP for Lyme Regis. And he took a monastery that had been empty for 100 years and created it really into what you see today. There's been very little done since he converted it. So he raised the cloisters and put another floor above the cloisters for his staterooms. He changed the sanatorium into what is probably one of the best rooms in the south of England, which is our saloon. He ordered the tapestries which now hang in there, which are Mortlake tapestries depicting the Acts of the Apostles that were drawn by Raphael for the Sistine Chapel. So they're quite special and probably the best thing in the house. And he put decorative plaster ceilings throughout the entire house. So going very against what Oliver Cromwell stood for, but has created a fantastic house that we now have today.
Fascinating. It took how many hundreds of years to build it?
Oh, I don't think they ever stopped building. So it was a monastery for 400 years and they were constantly building. But the key bit of it was about 250 years.
Unbelievable. So your family's lived here for 100 years.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how your family, the Ropers, came to live at Ford Abbey?
Going back, what we were talking about, Sir Edmund Prideaux, the Prideaux's, again, it went through the female line at the turn of the 18th century, and the Prideaux's became the Gwynne's. And between the Prideaux's and the Gwynne's, they occupied the Abbey for 200 years, by which time there were no heirs and there was no money. And so in 1846, it was sold to a Bristol merchant who tried to relocate down here and sadly didn't. They lasted about 20 years here before they resold it. And in 1864, a lady called Mrs. Bertram Evans bought it. She was a widow by that time with four children. And actually, it turns out she never really lived here. Although she'd bought it and paid for everything to be done and some of the modernisation to be done, she actually left it for her son, Herbert Evans, to live here. Between them, William Herbert married very late and didn't have any children. And so he left it to a cousin. And that cousin was called Elizabeth, and she'd married a chap called Freeman Roper. And they moved in 1905. So that's really when the Ropers moved into Ford. But obviously, indirectly, the family's been here since 1864.
Fascinating. And fascinating that strong line of women that have a great connection to your home.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
So what happened in the 70s? To your home?
The 70s, my parents moved in 1975, which is when I moved here. We're quite good at doing a kind of a periodic inspection, but my grandparents hadn't done a huge amount of maintenance. And we had a survey done of the house, and it was in a disastrous state, to put it mildly. A lot of the roofs, they were very close to falling down, especially the saloon, which is the main room of the house. The only thing actually keeping it up was the shape of the plaster ceiling of the room itself. So through the 70s, we were very lucky and got a lot of funding, but we were able to redo a lot of the roofs. And really, my mother modernised how the house runs so that we can live as it's a private house. And so she moved the kitchen, she put some bathrooms in, and actually they put some central heating in, which is quite nice.
I think that's so apt, isn't it, to make sure we make these homes livable for whatever the journey of our particular life is now. I mean, if I look at, for example, at Beaver, where the kitchen's been in this building, mm-hmm. and it fascinates me because it almost tells another story of another generation. And now we've all reduced, like most families, into one room.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And you think, well, we've got all this space. When the children are being a bit grand, they say, Mum, we've got all this space, but we seem to live in one room. But it, you know, you don't have the butlers and the staff running around. And so it's up to you, isn't it?
It's us now, isn't it? Yes, that's it. There's nobody else.
That's so true.
Yeah.
And I loved the quote that your father left you with. Do you want to just tell us about it?
Yes, I mean, he always lived by the quote that everything must change so that everything can stay the same. And it really means that you've always got to be thinking forward just to keep the place kind of really solvent and don't get left behind. You've always got to be thinking forward. You've got to be changing. Even if you don't want to change, you've got to think what's coming next. Even right to the end, he was key to this place's survival. He was very open-minded. He was always looking for new things to do. He started a tree nursery. He started a pick your own fruit. He set up forestry in Scotland. He opened the place on a commercial basis. You can't sit on these places and just do nothing. You have got to be looking forward and changing everything just to keep ourselves solvent the whole time. And I think it's almost a family kind of thing now, and we're always changing. And with my day-to-day stuff now, in addition to what my father did, you know, on a really small scale, you walk around the garden here and yeah, it's got to change. Everything's got to change. So that's what we do. We can't change the house because we're not allowed to, as you know, because English Heritage won't let us. So why not change everything else we do around it? whether it's business or what you look at.
Good for you, Alice. So Ford Abbey has had some extraordinary women in its past. Can you tell us about some of them, and in particular about Mrs. Evans?
Mrs. Evans, as we mentioned earlier, she bought the house in the 1860s, and she actually spent most of her time in London, although she spent a small fortune here. And she did some really good things, like she moved the farmyard, which was bang next door to the Abbey buildings itself. She moved them about a mile south of the Abbey. She also put in the most modern bit of the Abbey. She put a little corridor in up next door to the saloon so that the servants could get around the house without disturbing the occupants of the house. She invested in the farmyards and the estate itself. You know, she was the first person to really invest any sensible money in the place for about 200 years. So she was
a key player.
A key player, absolutely.
And how would you describe your role today, Alice?
Definitely custodian, and really just trying to keep it going, keep it, do I dare say, out of the National Trust's hands, and trying to keep ourselves solvent. I'd always love to kind of leave it in a much better state than we took it over. But as I've explained, my father did that in spades. So to follow that is quite a daunting prospect. But, you know, we keep trying to think of how we're going to push it forward and make it as financially stable as we possibly can before the next generation take on. I'm sure you feel exactly the same. It's that you are so responsible for keeping the show on the road and dealing with all the challenges that get thrown at us. I do run this place very much with my husband and us as a pair, and we kind of work together. If I can't get something done, he probably will.
So you've said in the past, the estate is a business. Our aim has always been to keep it as a family home and out of the hands of the National Trust. Would you mind just explaining, because this is such a big story to all the homes I know that I go and visit. It is like the big wolf at the end of the drive, isn't it, the National Trust? And most probably,
it is.
Quite sensibly, the government wouldn't want to take any more of these homes on anymore because they know how difficult and expensive they are to run. But what do we mean as private home owners by that statement?
I think it's important that we are different from what the National Trust are doing. And it is important that we are living in them and that each one of us, what we offer to the visitor effectively is a very personal experience. You know, we give them a working home. What they think of that, I don't know. I begin to think that a lot of people think when they come to these places, they're expecting us to present it like the National Trust. And I feel there is more and more pressure to produce that kind of clinical visitor experience, which I'm afraid I'm determined not to do. You know, they do see the family working bits, and they do see our dogs coming out the house, and they do see that there are people living in the grounds, and that actually most of my staff live in the grounds. So everybody who's living here is working here and trying to keep it going. And I think it's a much better experience and a better, well, it's more welcoming really than giving it to the National Trust and having them take everything out and clinicalising it.
So Alice, you're the fourth generation of ropers who live at Ford Abbey.
Yes.
Let's go back a little bit, if we may. Tell us about what you did in your early years and how you met your wonderful husband, Julian.
I trained as a chartered surveyor. So I left school and I ended up at Cirencester Agricultural College to study land management, and actually met him there. He is from Argentina. Well, his family farm in Argentina, and we met there and he stayed here. And so, yeah, about 8 years later, we got married.
How amazing. Presumably, were the family encouraging you to study land management in order to take over the pile?
Oh, not really. I'm one of three girls and I'm the eldest. And looking at my two sisters, I didn't think either of them appeared to want to take it over. So somebody had to. So I thought, well, you know, just as a teenager, I thought, well, that's what I've got to do. My father never really talked about it. He never talked about personal things. So you just had to assume. And I think he was quite glad when I came home. But it's probably like many other families in these places. It was never really talked about.
You've just touched on something that I find so fascinating, because that is so true, what you've just said. It isn't actually talked about. Sometimes the most obvious things are the most difficult to talk about, aren't they?
Yes.
Because, of course, the moment your father passed away, that would be the moment you took over the mantle. Is that how it worked?
No, I've been here for 27 years or so, but my father only died last September. So we very much ran it alongside each other for about 20 years.
Wonderful.
and he did his bit. And as he did less, I took on more. So it was a very slow takeover, which in a way was really nice. But on the other hand, working alongside your family can be quite challenging.
Yes.
So we tried to run very different parts of the estate and the house and things.
And you yourself have three children, that's right.
I do, yes, yes.
And do you have a son amongst those children?
I've got two sons and a daughter.
But it still would go to the oldest, or is it goes to the child who has the application to take the role on?
I think it will suddenly get offered to the eldest, but as my father-in-law has said, see who they marry before you make any final decisions. So the problem is all three of them will be quite capable of taking it on, but only one of them can. So it's really who shows the keenest thing and who really marries the one that will be capable of doing it alongside them, because it is, as you know, it's very much a joint job. You can't do it on your own.
No, exactly.
What Alice is speaking about here really resonates with me. Having the right life partner to take up this extraordinary responsibility with you is so very important, because both of you will not only be devoting your lives to each other, but to the estate as well. I really wanted to learn more about the Abbey and Alice's perspective on custodianship. Since we began Duchess the podcast, so many of you have reached out expressing the wish to make listening to Duchess a reality. We adore making this podcast, but we know nothing compares to experiencing these beautiful places for yourself. So, for people who want a once-in-a-lifetime experience, we've partnered with the award-winning luxury travel company Abercrombie & Kent to bring our much-loved podcast to life. From guided tours, stays in grand rooms, fishing trips on the family lake, to private tours of beautiful gardens, our partnership with Abercrombie & Kent will enable you to experience Duchess, the podcast, for yourself from Inverary to Beaver and beyond. With Abercrombie & Kent, you can come and stay, visit and explore the houses that are featured in our series Duchess. Our partnership with Abercrombie and Kent will enable you to experience Duchess the podcast for yourself with your own tailor-made itinerary. For more information, visit abercrombiekent.co.uk/duchess. We'll put a link in the show notes. This is just a quick reminder that you're listening to Duchess, hosted by me, Emma Rutland, and this is a podcast produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. Coming up in the podcast, Alice tells me about the transformative impact of the pandemic on her estate, and I learn why her home is such an intriguing architectural mix. But first, I wanted to know more about the famed medieval gardens on the estate.
So Ford Abbey has home some wonderful gardens for hundreds of years. Can you tell us about their history before the ropers arrived?
There are bits that date right back to the Cistercian monks, when the Cistercians were amazing farmers and they were very clever with water. And they built a leat that comes 2 miles round the hill and feeds what would have been their trout pond, which is now the main lake in the gardens. And from there, the leat continued and it went into their mill, where they then ground all their grain for all their animals. And that kind of forms the kind of the original part of the garden, although they wouldn't have looked upon it as a garden. And in the early 1700s, Francis Gwynn then did create the gardens that you see today, from the top lake, the Monk's Lake, creating a series of three connecting lakes down through the garden to the river, which lies to the north of us. And then he put in the big vistas that we have here. And that was in really the early 1700s, so just before Capability Brown was doing all his things. And it was a very formal garden in those days, with kind of walkways and things for perambulating, until really, until my great great-grandmother came along.
Can you tell us about the profound impact your family, the Ropers, have had on the gardens?
Yeah, I mean, I come from a very keen gardening family and really started my great-grandmother, who transformed the rock garden, and also her son, Geoffrey Roper, who was my grandfather. He was passionate about trees. He planted the arboretum in the gardens. He also planted, I mean, hundreds of thousands of trees on the estate. And it's interesting, we've got a book that has been written as an annual record. My grandfather did it, my father did it, and now I'm starting to do it, about what's happened on the estate and within the house each year. And it's lovely going back to his time, because it would go, oh, I planted this wood this year, I planted this wood this year. So yeah, he was literally converting fields into woodland. That led on to my father, who took over in the 1970s. And again, he really got into gardening in probably the early 80s. His passion was the bog garden, and he planted an awful lot of primulas. He was a man who had his favourites, and he loved magnolias, he loved his primulas, and he loved his Mechanopsis blue Himalayan poppies. So those were his kind of passions around the garden that he would really look after above everything else. And I think, to his credit, we then were awarded the Historic Houses Garden of the Year Award in 1992, which seems an awfully long time ago. But it was, you know, it was a great coup for us back then. And then one of the great things that Dad put in was our lovely 160-foot fountain, which we did in 2005, and really to celebrate the family being here 100 years. But we also, we had this enormous 50-kilowatt pump that was doing nothing, that we'd used before when we were running the fruit farm. But the fruit farm had kind of changed locations and things, so we just had this redundant pump. So we all sat down as a family and decided it was quite good to put the water in the air, and it's a great attraction nowadays. And so, yeah, and then I took over, well, on and off quite recently, really.
But here you are, and doing such a sterling job, Alice. So you've had a profound influence through lockdown on the gardens. Could you tell us a bit more about this?
When we first went into lockdown, I ended up with no head gardener and a shielding second gardener and a third gardener who resigned on the spot because I didn't furlough him. So I ended up with one gardener and me and 30 acres and no visitors. So I started my way through the garden. I had done kind of bits. I'd introduced the wildflower spiral and I'd extended the rock garden in places. But because Dad was such a great gardener and his sister, who is also involved in the garden, I didn't get involved at all until this point. And so I started gardening alongside and suddenly realised that there was an awful lot to do and it wasn't in the best condition that I was expecting. So we spent lockdown ripping out an awful lot of herbaceous, taking a lot of trees down and remodelling areas of the garden. And because we didn't have any visitors here, it was such a lovely couple of months to really transform two or three parts areas of the garden. And, you know, we wouldn't have done it if we hadn't had lockdown. Since then, we've carried on transforming it.
Amazing. So are you still doing the gardening?
I am, yes. Very much. I see the gardeners every day. I'm out there probably for 6 hours a day working alongside them when I'm not doing the management that, you know, we have to do.
And now you're the head gardener?
Yeah, very much so.
Well, amazing. What would your favourite spot be in your garden?
Oh, I think without doubt must be the rock garden, purely because it always, I don't know how we've managed it, but it's certainly not down to me, but it's through the generations. It just always looks good. There is not a time from beginning of January when the Coombe cyclamen come up right through to the end of November, there is always something in that bit of the garden that you can sit and enjoy. And it's also got the most stunning view back to the house. So you can't really beat it. It's the most wonderful little place in the garden.
And what, Alice, do you feel is the secret to a great British garden?
I think our duty for the garden, especially as we're open to the public, is that we should have something that is worth seeing at all times of the year or for as big a period of the time of the year as you can actually do. So I'm always trying to extend the seasons. I'm trying to create interest right from January all the way through to the end of November. I think December and January we do genuinely struggle with, but for the rest of the year, it is up to us. For a really good garden, there should always be something that's there for people to come and see and, you know, for interest. To have a garden that's just a spring garden or just a summer garden is boring for the rest of the year. So you want something that's going to give you joy at all times of the year. So it's quite diverse.
Well, I think you better come and give me a hand on that one then. because we have got very much a spring garden, and it is so difficult to extend those seasons sometimes. But scented daphne is one of my favourites, and they're great in January, February, aren't they?
They are lovely, yes. Yeah, to have those lovely early spring smells around the garden is very special.
So Ford Abbey is an architectural beauty. Can you give us some insight into the construction and its architecture?
Yeah, and bear in mind it's 900 years old, and it is a real mishmash of architectural styles. The monastic side of it is fairly medieval, and as you go along, many houses are built as a kind of a one-off with maybe some extensions on the sides and things. But the abbey here has got the private house really built within almost the monastic structure that was there before. So you've got the 17th century windows and sash windows that were put in alongside the medieval windows of the Great Hall and the extraordinary tower that Thomas Chard built in 1520. And it's extraordinary. I mean, it shouldn't work, but it does. Any architect that looks at it, it just goes, it's a real mishmash, but actually it's beautiful.
And you have a lovely river quite close to you.
We are right on the south side of the River Axe, which is the border between both Dorset and Somerset. So we literally sit and look at that and all the joys it entails when it floods. Yeah, we sit in the middle of nowhere, really. We're 4 miles from the nearest town and in the lovely Dorset countryside.
It was written about in being one of the best buildings in England, I believe.
Yes, like many of these great houses. You're always very honoured when somebody admires the house you're living in. But I think it's right. It is certainly one of the oldest houses as well. So it's got a huge history to it. Yes, I think we're very lucky. And I think I'd agree with him.
Oh, amazing. Tell us about this room that you're sitting in.
This is now my office. When I was a very small child and my parents were here, it was the pantry. It was full of cupboards where all the crockery and stuff was kept because it's next door to the dining room. Now it is our office and our meeting room. So it's very much a work-orientated room. Very plain, very utilitarian.
To a lot of our listeners, they'll be rather disappointed that we've all ended up spending our time in the service room, such as the pantry and the butler's bedroom.
Yep.
Which is exactly what this is, my office behind us, and exactly the same. It was a butler's bedroom.
Yes.
But that's where we are, I'm afraid, below stairs.
We are definitely below stairs nowadays.
So there are some beautiful interiors around the Abbey. Can you tell us about them? And if you have any favourite rooms, Alice?
Oh, I mean, the rooms in the Abbey are very interesting in that as you go through the Abbey, you can see both the monastic influence as well as the conversions of Sir Edmund Prideaux's. And also, I mean, the one thing the house is really known for is its plaster ceilings, which obviously were about 1650. As to favourite room, I mean, it'd be hard not to say the saloon because of the tapestries and of its ceiling. And there isn't a room that's much better in the south of England, really. But actually, real favourite, this is awful to say, probably our drawing room, just because it's cosy and it's nice. And it is still ornate. It has still got lovely plaster ceilings. It's got yet more tapestries in it, not as grand as the ones in the saloon. But it does just have that, you know, talking about our generation, that lovely homely feel to it. But it is still impressive to show to the visitors.
So the visitors come into your private drawing room?
No. Only on high days and holidays. But when we have music concerts and a few other things, we do open it, but not very often.
How many days out of interest, Alice, are you open to the public?
The gardens are every day from beginning of March till November, and the house is 5 days a week from April to the end of October.
Can you tell our listeners about the significance of your Mortlake tapestries and how it feels to have them actually in your home?
They are probably, yeah, they're the biggest treasure in the house for us. The tapestries in the saloon were woven at Mortlake in London, and they depict the Acts of the Apostles as done by Raphael for the Sistine Chapel in Rome. And he did the cartoons that were then woven in Brussels, and they were designed to hang below Michelangelo's ceiling in the Sistine Chapel on high days and holidays. And I think it was Henry VIII bought the cartoons, and then the Mortlake factory was set up, and Sir Edmund Prideaux had them ordered. And funnily enough, he actually died before they were presented to the house. And his son then supported Monmouth in his rebellion against the crown. So the tapestries for here weren't presented for 70 years. So what we are really lucky in that the tapestries now are effectively 70 years younger than any of their contemporaries that are also around the country. So there is a set at Chatsworth, but you can see the difference with ours being rolled up for 70 years compared with theirs. Ours have just got that much more colour and things in them, so they are a really good set. And so we are very, very precious with them and keep them in the dark and try and protect them as much as we can from the UV light and all that kind of stuff. But we bear in mind that they are 400 years old.
And they've hung with you for how many years?
They were represented to the house to Sir Francis Gwynne in about 1710.
So they've been hanging with you ever since?
Yes, so they've been with us, 300 odd years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. Outside the Mortlake tapestries, what are some of the most treasured heirlooms and works of art in the Abbey? And do you have any personal favourites?
Oh, that's difficult because we don't have anything of really what I call high value apart from the tapestries. The rest of it is all very much a story of here and the family. And probably my most favourite thing is the table that's up in the upper refectory, which was actually made by my grandfather, or my grandfather had it made, and he felled the tree that it came from, which was on the estate during the war, and hid it in a bramble patch because he didn't want it to be nicked for the war effort. And after the war, he had it made into a table that was actually designed to go in the Great Hall, but with a number of functions and things that we were doing about 20 years ago, it got moved up to the upper refectory. And it's just lovely to have something that was grown on the estate, made on the estate, and just looks lovely in the house. It's very plain, but it's just the story behind it. And what we always tell my children, what my father said, in the wood where the tree that it was felled from, in the middle of that stump is another oak growing, and it's as straight and as true as the one that table came from. And so it's one of those stories going down through the generations of when it's big enough, whoever is in charge of the Abbey must fell it and make a comparison bit of furniture for that table, which will be lovely. But I'll be well gone by the time that happens.
So sitting here today, what would you say, Alice Kennard, to six generations in the past if they were around that dining table with you sharing food?
I honestly don't know. It's six generations ago. It's a hell of a long time ago. I don't know. It's easier to say what would you do in the future, and that is keep going.
So we've got keep going to the future, and in the past, there must be some little something.
When you're going six generations back, you're almost back to your kind of Victorian times, and then this place was fairly quiet and fairly kind of run down by then. There wasn't that many people here. So what would you tell them, apart from get off your ass and make some money? But other than that.
And you will have six generations in the future. We could have had a few more COVIDs, a few more world wars, and yet these houses are still standing.
Yeah, patting them on the back saying, well done, you're here still.
Yeah, and that's the magic of what we're really doing, is just keeping it going and keep the roofs on.
Keep the roofs on, keep it going, yeah.
I always say it's a partnership with people running private heritage.
Yeah.
And if you get that, it's a big welcoming handshake to say, come in, share our home, love it like we do. And we're all doing our little bit to hand this over for another generation.
Yes.
And what an extraordinary, extraordinary story of your home, Alice.
Thank you.
I feel completely honoured to have chatted to you, and I'm definitely going to come and see you at Ford Abbey.
It would be lovely to see you.
Take care.
Thank you.
God bless.
Well, my dear listeners, what an absolute treat this has been. I feel like Alice and I are kindred spirits when it comes to our perspectives on heritage. Speaking to her, she has such a wealth of knowledge and so much passion when delivering it. Whether it's the brilliantly preserved architecture of her abbey, her beautiful gardens, or the wonderful tapestries that line her home, Alice is clearly a woman that will fight for heritage and protect every aspect of her home. Ford Abbey has been here for 900 years, and as long as women like her are at the helm, it will survive for 900 more. Thank you so much, Alice, for joining me on the podcast today, and thank you all for listening. Next week on the podcast, I will be meeting Paris Ackrill of Broughton Hall Estate. In the episode, Paris describes the incredible well-being centre they are developing on the estate. I learn about the Victorian Wonder Woman who lived at Broughton, and we discuss some of the incredible farming and sustainability projects that are transforming the surrounding landscape. We'll see you there. With Her Majesty the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year, we want to mark this momentous occasion by celebrating women in public service and heritage today. Join me, Emma Rutland, and my dear friend, Nicholas Coleridge, CBE, Chairman of the Victoria and Albert Museum and former President of Condé Nast, at Beaver Castle on the 30th of June for a live Q&A with some of my previous guests on Duchess, celebrating the Queen's Platinum Jubilee and the third series of Duchess. The Q&A will be followed by a scrumptious lunch in the state dining room at my very own Beaver Castle, where you can meet the incredible women who've inspired and appeared on Duchess. You will also have the opportunity to tour the castle and gardens for free. Hurry, there is only 100 tickets on sale for this exclusive event. You can find more information about this event on our website, www.duchessthepodcast.com. I very much look forward to welcoming you to Beaver very soon. With summer approaching and spring in full swing, picnics and walks in Bluebell Woods can return. We've been busy designing a range of high quality, sustainable products, perfect for taking on your picnic this summer. Handmade in the UK and designed by me, our products are helping to diminish the use of single-use plastics and bringing you elegant, sustainable alternatives. To view our range of gorgeous products, go to our website www.duchessthepodcast.com or through our Instagram account at Duchess the Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. There are just a few quick notes before we go. Make sure you follow Duchess wherever you listen to podcasts. One of my favourite things about the podcast is learning more about you and hearing your stories. So please write to me, tell me about your own lineage, and share with me the women who've inspired you in your life, at Duchess, thepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer, Kasra Ferruzia is the editor and audio-visual engineer, Connor Foley is the producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofides. Lady Violet Manners, my daughter, is executive producer with additional support from Henry Merrick. Thank you so much for listening to Duchess.